Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the E.N. Thompson Forum on World Issues on Noon Forum. The E.N. Thompson Forum is co-sponsored by the Cooper Foundation, the LEAD Center, and the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, March 28, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Today's guest speaker will be Donald Worster, the Hall Distinguished Professor of American History at the University of Kansas. He'll speak on the topic, An Unquenchable Thirst, How the Great Plains Created a Water Abundance and Then Lost It. Dr. Worster's presentation was co-sponsored by the symposium 1862-2012, The Making of the Great Plains. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the sponsors of the E.N. Thompson Forum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Lloyd Ambrosius, Samuel Clark Waugh Distinguished Professor of International Relations and a Professor of History at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln.
This evening's lecture, An Unquenchable Thirst, How the Great Plains Created a Water Abundance and Then Lost It, by Professor Donald Worster, is co-sponsored by UNL's Center for Great Plains Studies as part of its symposium on 1862-2012, The Making of the Great Plains, in collaboration with the Homestead National Monument. Water usage and food production in the Great Plains have global implications. This lecture will present the current issues relating to water, agricultural production, the natural environment, economic development, and global food security within the historical context of the 1862 legislation that shaped the Great Plains. Don Worster is the Hall Distinguished Professor of American History at the University of Kansas. He is one of the pioneers of environmental history. A past president of the American Society for Environmental History, he sits on several editorial boards and is advisory editor for the Cambridge University Press monograph series, Studies in Environment and History. Now, Professor Worster has received several honors, fellowships, and awards. He was the first non-scientist to receive the Distinguished Achievement Award from the Society for Conservation Biology, as simply one example of the awards he has received. Now join me in welcoming Don Worster to Nebraska.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, Cornhuskers. I can't see any of you from up here. This is the lights are so bright. But thank you, Professor Ambrosius, for your introduction. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to do all the things you promised. It seems I'm sitting at in the intersection of two different events, and I'll try to bridge them both. But undoubtedly, some of that will not be covered tonight. It is always a great pleasure to be back in Lincoln from Baja, Nebraska, Kansas. I'm always amazed how many stimulating, interesting, impressive faculty and students you've got here. I just had a session with some of your undergraduates, the Thompson Scholars. What a great group of kids they are. But each time I discover something new about Nebraska that I hadn't paid attention to or known before. The last time I was here was for a Darwin conference, a controversial subject, I suppose, here, but a great conference. And afterwards, we got to see the cranes. This time today, I got to see Love Library. I mean, what a name for a library. Love Library, I do. I'm not even sure my title is actually accurate. I shouldn't be talking about lost it, but I am going to be talking about losing it. And maybe there's a difference here that is important to try to understand. For a sensitive soul living in Kansas or Nebraska, and we're all sensitive souls in this part of the world, reading the reports of earlier travelers along the Platte River can produce an inferiority complex. so many aspersions, so much denigration of this, our home country. Here's Charles Ferguson following the trails westward to the California gold fields in 1849. Quote, "If the government would offer me a patent of all the land from Fort Kearney to Fort Laramie, I would not accept it." The whole country seemed utterly barren to him. That narrow ribbon of life threading its way from the Rockies to the Missouri, the river named by the French explorers, the Platte, came in for more abuse. Father Pierre-Jean de Smet, a native of Belgium, saw the river in 1840 and called it the most wonderful and most useless river of the rivers of North America. An American soldier described it as bad to ford, destitute of fish, too dirty to bathe in, and too thick to drink. Major Osborne Cross was impressed with its total uselessness and insignificance. And then, this is another military man, maybe that's a bias, I don't know. General W.S. Harney wrote in 1855, "In truth, this Platte River is a humbug. It is about dry, and a person can cross it dry shod." Well, they exaggerated, but as rivers go, the Platte emphatically did not seem up to the American standard. Today, for all of its beauty, does it seem even more diminished and insignificant? Less than ever a cause for pride. Despite its foul, gritty taste, we have managed in some years to drink it nearly dry. Here in Nebraska, a land of big open skies, dry skies, and little surface water, Americans raised in a culture of abundance came face to face with scarcity. To be sure, a few forms of scarcity had already appeared in the eastern part of the continent, disappointing those seeking homes and opportunity in Maine, Arkansas, Illinois. In those places, scarcity might have meant deforestation, or lack of cheap land, or rivers controlled and polluted by industry. But Nebraska, in general, presented a more fundamental and discouraging form of scarcity, unless you wanted to mine gold, I mean farther west from here. For those who needed a farm to make a living, and they were the vast majority of Americans before the 20th century, the Great Plains and the West that lay beyond them were not a land of plenty, but often a land of paucity and poverty. Looking back, we can see foreshadowed in those first discouraged reactions to Western scarcity our modern anxieties about the limits of nature. However, today, in contrast to westward-moving farmers of the mid-19th century, we're facing not a region marked by semi-aridity, but a planet experiencing overcrowded cities, highways, and supermarkets, diminishing opportunities for growth, increasing competition for food, land, and other resources, and a rising fear and malaise about the future. And once again, water stands at the center of concern. Almost every country has to worry about its future supplies. The Canadians are free of it, but the rest of us are worried. Accessible drinking water adds up to only 2 to 3% of the total supply of water on this planet. Most of it is seawater. And that relatively small amount of fresh water is not equally distributed. Altogether, 7 billion people must share whatever there is, and another 2 or 3 billion are on the way. The world's thirst is getting bigger, and now we are drinking the earth dry. The Platte, historical and contemporary, has become a kind of prototype of the planet. Boosters tell us to relax and be hopeful. After all, look at what we have done with Nebraska and the other Great Plains states. Look at what they have become. They are now home to 10 million people, 35 million if we add Texas, producing a huge share of America's bread and meat, making a significant contribution to civilization. And much of that success has come from learning how to use water efficiently. The optimists say the rest of the world should study our achievement. What we have done in this place, others can do anywhere on earth. To that reassuring optimism, I want to offer two caveats. First, what we have achieved on the Great Plains has demonstrated a lot of technological ingenuity. But such ingenuity is itself limited and has had unintended consequences. And second, what we have achieved has required a lot of cultural change, to the point that we look rather different from the people who came west along the old Oregon Trail and the Platte River Road. But that changed culture, still an imperfect adaptation, a work in progress, is undergoing stress, criticism, and uncertainty. In short, we have a more sobering history to remember. And I want to remember it with you tonight. What can you do when the natural world does not treat you as kindly as you think you ought to be treated, especially when you've been raised in a culture of abundance? After that initial round of reactions to the water situation on the Great Plains, which mixed realism with hyperbole, Americans simply tried to forget, ignore the condition of aridity. They closed their eyes to the long chronicle of Native Americans moving in and out of the plains, suffering through cycles of drought and hunger. They blindly drew lines on maps that paid no attention at all to the flow of water across the surface. The Homestead Act, passed by Congress in 1862, divided the prairies into interchangeable little boxes of 160 acres each that had no relation to environmental variability. That act assumed the infinite benevolence of nature. Would politicians have voted for that act, the 1862 Homestead Act, had they understood that both rain on the plains and runoff from the Rockies were so unevenly, so unfairly distributed across the land? And then as they assembled those homesteads and counties into larger boxes, the scarcity of water again was ignored. They paid no attention to the shape and pattern of watersheds. Thus, we ended up with a spectacle of the Republican River, which begins in eastern Colorado, flows through Nebraska and into Kansas, and flows right on down to fierce battles over which state gets its water, a question embroiled at this very moment in litigation. And my friends in Kansas are sure we're going to get it. But we wouldn't have had this problem, or at least as severe as we've had it, had we thought about water from the beginning. Before there were climate change deniers, there were aridity deniers. They saw the country as they wanted to see it, and they wanted to see it as forever green and bountiful, with liberty and abundance for all. It took successive waves of drought to make the point that Western America was not as well supplied with water and other resources as people wanted it to be. Severe droughts occurred in the 1890s and again in the 1930s, catching people unprepared and creating a tragedy of lost homes, shattered lives, and land degradation. Again and again, the Great Plains have been, as I wrote a few years ago, our cultural boneyard, where the evidence of bad judgment and misplaced schemes are strewn about like bleached skulls. When you can no longer deny that a harsh reality is staring you in the face, you may begin to hope that technology can come to the rescue. Have faith in the ability of people to find water where there seems to be none. Such hope can lead to junk science. where one relies on faulty data to advance a dubious cause. In 1871, the University of Nebraska appointed the Reverend Samuel Augie to its science faculty, a position he used to advocate the view that plowing up the grasslands would change atmospheric physics and bring rain. He lasted 12 years at the university. His theory much longer as a classic example of wishful thinking. Nelson Horatio Darton, I guess he used the whole name most of the time, was a better scientist, and his research into the region's geology would have enduring merit, laying the foundations for the modern era of deep well irrigation. In 1903, the U.S. Geological Survey published his descriptions of a formation he called the Ogallala, using the name of the town nearest a prominent outcropping of this ancient sedimentary outwash. He described the formation as impure grit, pebbles, and sand cemented with carbonate of lime. Not a very attractive-sounding description. Debris that was once eroded from the Rocky Mountains and spread out over 130,000 square miles from New Mexico to Nebraska. On average, it lay 200 feet below the surface and was saturated with ancient rainwater that had seeped down at the rate of a few inches per year over a period of more than 10 million years. The volume of water, wrote Darton, appears to be large at nearly all localities. Later scientists would discover that the depth and volume of this natural reservoir varies considerably, with the largest amount of the aquifer, two-thirds of it, in fact, concentrated under the sand hills, where unfortunately there is not much arable land on the surface. I come from the part, the other third, the south of here, and so most of my comments tonight may reflect that perspective and a little bit of jealousy. Darton's scheme was real. His science, that it was real, if still preliminary. But it was soon corrupted with popular claims that this and other high plains aquifers were, quote, inexhaustible, unquote. Great underground lakes, it was said, would make drought a thing of the past, allow a new crop of bountiful crop production, prevent another dust bowl, and bring lasting abundance to this land of sometimes disheartening scarcity. Now, a gallon of water weighs more than 8 pounds. How do you lift up a gallon of water from deep underground, and not only 1 gallon at a time, but thousands and even millions of gallons? How do you lift that much water up to irrigate a corn or cotton crop? It would take advanced pump technology and a lot of gasoline, natural gas, or diesel fuel to power that work. Pumping the High Plains aquifer first began down in the Texas Panhandle soon after World War II. By the late 1970s, farmers had punched 170,000 wells into the aquifer and were pumping enough water to cover 23 million acres to a depth of 1 foot. Today, there are over 200,000 wells. Agriculture has boomed with this water. $10 billion, $20 billion worth of production a year, pouring out of a region that was once dismissed as a wasteland. Originally touted as an emergency remedy, this water, deep underground water, to be used in times of drought, deep well irrigation soon became the normal, everyday mode of agriculture, replacing much of the old sodbuster and dry land farming way of life. This flood of new water, which is, of course, really ancient water, pumped up from the Pleistocene, permitted more crops than humans could directly consume. It was used to irrigate feed grains on which cattle fattened. Cattle moved in from the native rangelands to CAFOs, the confined animal feeding operations, or feedlots, where they were fed on corn and soybeans instead of grass. and to get as close as possible to the rounded up cattle, the penned up pigs, and the pumped up water, the meatpacking industry deserted its historic base in Chicago, Omaha, and Kansas City and resettled on the plains. A new economy based on a new technology had evolved in the space of a few decades. The transformation has seemed miraculous, almost biblical in its majesty. Some, in fact, are sure that God put that water down there for Americans to discover just when we needed it most, and has guided the hand that designed the center pivot rigs and the pumps and the drop sprinkler heads that have created those round green checkers on the old checkerboard of the homesteader. But if it was God or nature that had laid down those underground deposits of water and fuel, it was humans who discovered and brought them to the surface, turning them into wealth. The mayor of Lubbock, Texas, bragged, "The history of this country is that as the need arose for anything, somebody was there with the right tool to take care of it. That is the way this country was built." What he did not say was that this country was not built to last. Irrigated agriculture could not be sustained indefinitely. In fact, by 1980, after a few years of unrestrained pumping, the limits of this new technological abundance were becoming clear. Over the past 5 or 6 decades, the Great Plains have become a mining economy. We mine for coal, we mine for oil, we mine for natural gas, and we mine for water. We mine much of that fossil energy to pump fossil water to produce food. And fossil energy is getting more and more expensive. The mounting costs may put farmers out of the irrigation business before their wells run dry. At the same time, the stark fact is that lots of water wells are running low or running dry. Some have been dry for a long time now, maybe not in this state, but in other Great Plains states. Others are falling rapidly, and more will shut down in our lifetime. Records show that between World War II and the mid-1970s, groundwater withdrawals increased by 500%. In that period of irrigation exuberance, some farmers were pumping up water at 100 times the recharge rate. That is, each year, a half inch or an inch of water or 2 inches might soak down into the aquifer while the farmer was pumping up 4 to 6 feet. By 1975, the overdraft was as large as the annual flow of the Colorado River. Following that time of frenetic expansion, much was done to improve efficiency and to moderate demand. Farmers tried to use each gallon of water more carefully, but still the depletion went on. In fact, we are now withdrawing about 18 times the flow of the Colorado River annually. Well measurements made by the Kansas Geological Survey show that the High Plains aquifer in some Kansas counties has been thoroughly depleted. Parts of other counties have a lifespan of less than 25 years, although the biggest share of the aquifer in southwestern Kansas will not be depleted for another 50 or more years. So we are not in an imminent crisis up and down the Great Plains, but these data can be deceptive. It is anybody's guess how many more years we have left of pumping. Most estimates simply extrapolate from current rates. But over the next 50 years, we may see a much higher level of pumping that could exhaust the entire aquifer faster than anybody expects. Why can we not count on the current rate continuing on and on and on? Well, basically because planet Earth is warming up at an unprecedented rate, and the Great Plains and the rest of the West will get more than their share of the heat. This is the prediction of the vast majority of climate scientists who've been studying the atmospheric pollution caused by greenhouse gases, the byproduct of burning those fossil fuels like coal and oil. There are a few outspoken skeptics, most of them politicians. read Merchants of Doubt if you want to know who some of these people were. They were against the arguments about tobacco and cancer a long time ago. But nearly all scientists who study climate and many of the world's political and economic leaders are not skeptics. They're worried. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the world's most eminent authority on the subject, co-recipient of Nobel Prize, has calculated that the Earth's surface temperatures could rise by this century's end anywhere from 3 to 10 degrees on the Fahrenheit scale. Turning to the Great Plains, the IPCC says simply, temperature increases in central North America will be higher than the global mean, accompanied on average by reduced summer precipitation and soil moisture. A more precise prediction for the North American mid-continent, which comes from the Canadian Center for Climate Modeling and Analysis in British Columbia. This model tells us to expect before the present century is finished that air temperatures over North America, the grasslands and croplands, on average will rise by 12% and may rise higher than that in the central and southern latitudes. An ominous brown spot will appear over the Texas-Oklahoma panhandle and spread outward for hundreds of miles. Now, it doesn't quite reach Lincoln, so we're safe. But unlike droughts in the 1950s and the 1960s or the 1930s, this one will not be temporary. It will be a relentless and permanent desiccation lasting for centuries. In the wake of these climate changes, the lament heard up and down the Great Plains will sound like this: no rain in sight. Not much rain last year either, or the decade before. The ground has no plant cover. The wind is starting to blow the topsoil away. The blue, unclouded skies are turning to darkness. Those words would have described conditions prevailing in the Dust Bowl years of the 1930s, and unintentionally, we may be bringing them back with a vengeance. But this time, disaster will come not only from plowing up fragile lands, but also from burning fossil fuels that produce greenhouse gases and alter the climate. Ironically, the big solution to the Dust Bowl was supposed to be deep well irrigation based on fossil fuel energy. It was supposed to liberate us from scarcity and vulnerability, to give us what a Department of Agricultural official called a climate-free agriculture. But the solution may prove its own undoing. Irrigation based on mining fuel along with water may, if it continues much longer, severely impact agriculture and help make this region a less fertile one. Already there are signs that the Great Plains are more desolate than they were during the 1840s overland migration to Oregon and California. I'm not just talking about how green it has been this year or what the rainfall this year has been. We have to look at the longer term for one thing. But I want to point your attention to something else. Back in the 1840s, the Platte may have been less a river than Americans were accustomed to seeing. It may have been unpleasant to drink, but at least it was there. Some water could be found flowing in it and in other rivers and streams across the land. This is not always the case today. Streams that once flowed are now dry. Green plants and animal life that surface water once supported have declined, except in a few protected areas. The reason is simple but seldom remarked. The source of surface water other than mountain snow are the natural springs fed by groundwater and aquifers. Deplete the aquifers and you deplete the streams. The two are intricately connected. Deplete the aquifers and you deplete the ecological communities that depend on them. Deplete the aquifers and you also deplete the human communities that have come to depend on water, just as migrating birds, riverbank trees and flowers, fish, frogs, and raccoons do. An example of how water systems are interconnected below and above ground, and how human intervention can disrupt those connections comes from Western Kansas. In 1944, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation and the Army Corps of Engineers set aside their long rivalries. They launched the joint Pick-Sloan, or Missouri Basin, program to build dams and reservoirs. They promised to save farmers from the ordeal of another Dust Bowl. By damming the Missouri River and all of its tributaries and bringing irrigation water to fields. One such project was Cedar Bluff Dam and Reservoir on the Smoky Hill River, located about 300 miles southwest of Lincoln. By 1951, the dam was built. An irrigation canal was finished. Lots of money had been spent. And then the whole scheme came undone. The Smoky Hill River, which was supposed to fill the reservoir, unexpectedly began to diminish in flow. Designed to store as much as 500,000 acre-feet of water, enough water to cover 500,000 acres a foot deep, the reservoir is this very week holding only 80,000 square feet. The irrigation canal sits there unused. According to the Bureau of Reclamation, and I quote, "The Cedar Bluff unit is an unfortunate example of how Mother Nature can undo even the most thoroughly thought-out plans." The Bureau blames recent years of drought. The engineers should be blaming not Mother Nature, but man-made global warming and, even more pointedly, man-caused aquifer depletion. They failed to consider how deep well irrigation development might dry up the surface flow. Some land got wetter thanks to the aquifer, but other land and rivers got drier as the aquifer was depleted. So in this case, technological ingenuity ironically has led to a waste of tax dollars, failed promises of agricultural abundance, and a diminished river and its ecology. And now the Bureau touts its shrunken reservoir as a natural paradise for hunters and fishermen. And is a place where you can fill your creel with introduced walleye, carp, and largemouth bass. But the dry and lifeless Smoky Hill River has another story to tell. So there is a darker and a more ambiguous truth behind technological abundance. Americans have transformed, as we could paraphrase Father DeSmet, a most wonderful and most useless environment into a homeland for millions of human immigrants. And by the miracle of technology, we have made that homeland wonderful in some ways and more useful to our species. But at what cost? And what about the future? Will there be enough water to sustain us? Slowly, with much resistance, we are beginning to see the end of the culture of infinite abundance, man-made or natural. From this point on, every resource will be limited. Water, energy, minerals, the atmosphere, open space, quiet nights, the diversity of life, places of natural beauty. And every resource will have competing users. Let's step back a long bit for a moment. A few centuries ago, Europe and Asia suddenly came together across vast oceans. And squarely in the middle of those oceans that had long divided them, they discovered two entire continents, along with Australia and Oceania, whose existence they had never suspected. They called that discovery the New World. It was not really new, hardly uninhabited. I'd suggest that we call it instead a second world, not New World, but a second world, potentially as big as the first and full of unexploited wealth. Today, that second world has become heavily depleted and exploited, and there is no next world floating somewhere out at sea or lying between us and the moon. The rise of a modern culture of abundance promised an inexhaustible supply of natural resources. The culture first took root a long way from here, London, Amsterdam. It was revolutionary in scope. Instead of emphasizing frugality, restraint, and communitarian values, it taught self-reliance, individualism, freedom. Modern capitalism could only have taken root and flourished as it has with that second world of abundance. Greed became a virtue, challenging centuries of moral teaching that had made greed one of the deadliest sins, or as the Bible tells us, the root of all evil. In contrast to that teaching, the economist Adam Smith, one of the greatest prophets of the new culture, argued that unregulated pursuit of self-interest should be the organizing principle of society. He suggested that an invisible hand would assure peace and harmony. That hand, we can now see, was nothing more than the material abundance of the second world, conquered and possessed by the Europeans. Americans brought Adam Smith west, expecting an invisible hand to guide and protect them wherever they went. To be sure, older ideas survived and came west too, ideas of community, mutual aid, religion, and so forth. But none of them was as powerful or dominant as faith in the great invisible hand. Yet for some time now, that faith has been losing ground across the United States, including Nebraska, Kansas, and neighboring states. It has been shaken by the hard facts of economic failure, the persistence of scarcity in water and other resources, and the inability of unregulated self-interest to overcome that scarcity. From the 1930s to the present, the culture of the Great Plains has been shifting slightly toward more communitarian values. We can see this in a growing dependence on the federal government for assistance, drought assistance, by the billions of dollars. We can see it in the spreading of risk from this part of the country all over the nation to taxpayers, to clamoring for increased security and for welfare. And we can see it in changing attitudes toward water. The earliest law of groundwater on the plains was based on the rule of capture, which is still predominant over much of Texas, but nowhere else. It comes from Caribbean pirates preying on Spanish galleons loaded with gold. It comes from hunters shooting their way through the wilderness, from generations of oilmen drilling for elusive petroleum under their feet. Applied to groundwater, the law of capture says that while water in aquifers may theoretically belong to the public, when you pump it out, you make it your exclusive property to buy and sell as you choose. Such a rule, such an ethic, once seemed appropriate when groundwater seemed so abundant that no one who made a little effort would go thirsty. When groundwater pumping began in the Texas Panhandle and then spread northward, the rule of capture was the law. The explosive growth of deep well irrigation in the 1950s and 60s and 70s came from entrepreneurs who followed that law. They saw an opportunity for profit, and they seized it. Had the High Plains aquifer been truly inexhaustible, that kind of economic individualism might still be dominant. And the waterscape would look as crowded, chaotic, and competitive as an oil patch. But soon after World War II, a cultural change began, and it gained momentum with increased pumping. Again, I turn to Kansas as an example. In 1977, the state legislature made it a criminal offense to pump water for non-domestic use without a state permit. Earlier, the legislature had declared all water within the state of Kansas dedicated to the use of the people of the state, subject to the control and regulation of the state. That is, the legislature has been consistently expanding the concept of public property and giving state officials the power to impose restraint on individual water claims and rights. Why? In order to protect the High Plains aquifer. Part of that backlash against unregulated individualism was the establishment of five groundwater management districts in the western half of Kansas. For the first time, local people began joining together to prevent overdevelopment of the water resource. The state asked for local recommendations in drafting regulations that would extend the life of the aquifers. And mainly the districts called for rules about what? The spacing of wells. But they also began to call for putting more prohibitions on wasting water, on putting meters on pumps to make farmers aware of how much water they were pumping, and in the most radical proposals, reducing the amount of water used in agriculture to match the recharge rate. I mean, they're talking about this in at least one of the groundwater managed districts in Kansas. In other words, sustained yield management. Most of them, frankly, are admitting we are mining the water. It will be gone someday. We are trying to stretch it out to make a slow transition back to dry farming, which I think is probably the most realistic view. Nebraska, of course, took a similar approach, setting up 24 natural resource districts whose boundaries are based for the first time, I think this is quite interesting, on the state's river basins. These water management districts, now getting under 30 years old, acknowledge that natural resources are not unlimited. They also acknowledge that water is a public good with social as well as individual value. Water, more than a resource like oil, has no substitutes. We can live without oil. We cannot live without water. We will die without water. And when a resource so basic as water becomes scarce, then they are saying basically to all of us, the invisible hand cannot be trusted to sort it out its use and distribution. People must agree to make rules that limit self-interest in the name of community. The establishment of water resource districts is a rejection of the notion that technology by itself or the invisible hand can guarantee abundance forever. More and better pumps or more efficient conservation is not enough. The scarcity is real, and scarcity requires community-based rules on use, distribution, and stewardship. Call it a moral economy of water. Every economy, to be sure, is a moral economy. That is, every economy, even Adam Smith's, is based on ideas of fairness and justice. But historians usually mean by moral economy one that follows strong communitarian principles, in contrast to those more libertarian ideals made famous by Smith. In contrast to the market economy, a moral economy allows the community's moral ideals and moral traditions to influence the production and the distribution of goods. Such is the purpose of the water management district. It does not exist to promote a free market philosophy, but instead tries to put a brake on markets. The brake may be heavy, it may be light, but its function is to slow down the depletion of a vital resource and distribute a limited supply of water as fairly as possible. Now, it seems to me that this moral economy in water, which is in every Great Plains state today, even Texas, is not altogether new. This particular moral economy rests on some old and traditional values that found their way to Nebraska. In some ways, they are too traditional for the world of today and tomorrow. For example, the water district promotes the idea that turning prairies into farm commodities and rivers and aquifers into irrigation supplies is always an unquestioned good. The highest and best use of water in the Great Plains moral economy must be to produce wheat and corn, pigs and beef. According to this way of thinking, those who produce food or fiber are the ones who ought to make the decisions. And in fact, generally it is farmers who control local decisions on water and land for their own benefit and that of future generations. A school teacher or a merchant in town may or may not agree completely with the values of those agriculturalists, but they have little voice in matters that may vitally affect them. And no one in that traditional moral economy speaks for the birds, the rivers, or the ecology of the region, or stands up for what nature might need for its health and survival. In other words, the moral economy of the plains is agrarian in principle and in power. It is not urban, and it is not ecological. Why should it be otherwise, say the farmers? We use 90% of the water, and our way of life is about all that matters. I'm sympathetic. I come from farming people in western Kansas. I'm sympathetic with that argument and so on. But I also have to realize that any economy, moral or otherwise, is always undergoing change. And over time, this one may change toward a different perspective. Someday, water may be seen as good for more than agriculture and rural communities. But only if such cultural evolution has a chance. It may be stopped in its tracks, along with the whole idea that social values should influence our use of water. A powerful threat is on the rise, a resurgent market economy. If it succeeds in winning people over, it will bring an end to the present or future moral economy. Market is the magic word these days, spreading through law schools, economics departments, think tanks, especially on the right, and even among some environmentalists. Books and articles are popping up everywhere to promote water marketing. They promise to rescue us from old-fashioned agrarian values, to end waste and scarcity, and to bring us once more to a new world of infinite possibilities. Markets are supposed to be a wonderful sovereign remedy for every problem, whatever ails us. They are the new panacea. The proponents of water marketing do not like groundwater management or natural resource districts, for they make rules and impose them on the individual. Even when the district is a local authority, not a state or federal agency, it imposes a concept of the public good on everyone. When the public good is defined narrowly in agricultural terms, the marketers have a good case to make that water is trapped in a stagnant, outmoded set of values. But the critics go farther. They like to quote the Austrian economist Friedrich Hayek, who warned against the tyranny of government planning and centralized management. Like Hayek, the water marketers argue that no one can ever know what the public good is. We have a lack of knowledge on that question. It can only be what scattered individuals want. And no one in government, even at the most local level, can ever know what every individual wants. They go on to say all values are subjective and private, and only individuals know what they are. Only they can know what is best for them. So we must set individuals free from all planners, politics, collective values, and community control, and let them pursue their own desires. The solution to scarcity offered by water marketers is simple. Let the market put a price on water, and let it become private property that can be bought and sold to the highest bidder. This is an idea that is hugely popular in parts of California today, among environmentalists, economists, et cetera, but it's not limited there. There are plenty of articles out there about water marketing on the Great Plains. Remove all restrictions on owning, shipping, trading, or conserving this resource. Let water flow to those who will put it to the most profitable use. And it's not likely to be irrigated corn. If the marketers succeed, water will flow increasingly to cities and industry, to Los Angeles or to Denver. It will flow away from agriculture. By market logic, that will be good for the nation, good for generating wealth, and good for the environment. When water carries a price set in a competitive market, it's supposed to be used more efficiently. Farmers will stop wasting millions of gallons on irrigating corn in Nebraska. The market is the best way to allocate a limited resource. But note that what the marketers promise is not merely that markets are the best way to deal with scarcity. They're also the way to bring back abundance. For water scarcity, they say, is simply a problem in allocation and efficiency in supply and demand. As Daniel Rogers writes in his recent prize-winning book, Age of Fracture, it was Ronald Reagan and his chief economic advisor, Milton Friedman, an admirer of Hayek, who revived market ideology. They were reacting to what they regarded as the chaotic and pessimistic years of the 1970s, the malaise of the Carter years, and the national pessimism of that time. In contrast, Reagan and the marketeers promised a new era of limitless dreams, lying ahead if we could learn to think about society, in Rogers' words, as an array of consenting, voluntarily acting individual pieces. By reviving individualism and competition, the country would once more become a land of abundance. Rogers notes, in its very simplifications, the ideology of free markets filled a yearning for clarity that the older, more complex pictures of society could not. It just seemed so simple, so easy to get there. We might add that markets also seem to overcome complex environmental conditions and environmental limits. Wherever there is demand, the marketers promised, there will always be supply. 30 years after Reagan and Friedman, the call has gotten louder and louder in some circles. Put up all water for sale to the person with the most money or the greatest desire to buy, and then all our problems of living on the Great Plains will be solved. Now, I think there's no question that markets have enormous attractions and effectiveness at times. They work very well in some times and places. But there are several reasons why this advice might not be a good idea. First, water and all resources will end up being distributed even more unequally than now. Inequality will increase. There's an old saying in the West that water flows uphill to money. If that has been so in the past, despite the efforts of many institutions to save and distribute water according to some idea of justice, then how much more rapidly will water flow uphill when those institutions are destroyed? When water ceases to be a public good and becomes simply a privately owned commodity, soon only the biggest industrialist will be left in the countryside, the industrial agriculturalist, able to pay for the water. And in the cities, water, like gas, will become more and more expensive. We end up giving out water stamps to the poor? Or will the very idea of subsidizing the poor fall under the hammer of market logic? And what about the environmental consequences of water marketing? Will putting a competitive price on water lead to its conservation or to the restoration of depleted rivers, lakes, and ecosystems? When has putting a price on nature ever protected or preserved it? More likely, we will consume it more voraciously than we do today. And how can the market protect ecology? The marketers argue that environmentalists should bid on the natural world and buy whatever they want to protect. Well, in the past, a few rich men and women have tried to do that. Thus, we have a few parks, thanks to their philanthropy. But most environmentalists are not so rich, and they cannot pay the full cost of protecting the Platte River, let alone planet Earth. Anyway, is it their responsibility alone to pay for the public good? Or is caring for the earth a collective social responsibility, not the responsibility of some people, while the rest remain free riders? And therein lies the core question we face with water, here in this state and elsewhere in the world. Does water, along with all the goods and services that nature provides for us, have merely an economic value? Can its worth be measured in prices? Or is water not only an unpriced, but unpriceable good? Is water in all the forms it takes and all the life it supports no different from petroleum, a commodity we divert, we pump, and we make profits on? Or does it have a different meaning and value? Those are profound questions that need to be discussed in the public forum, this kind of forum. Hard as it may be to imagine such a discussion going on in the current political atmosphere nationally, it is a necessary discussion to have. The water marketers want to avoid such moral issues completely. Those issues, they insist, are too private and subjective. But if we cannot reason together and arrive at common meanings and values, then what holds our society together? Money and money alone? Thinking about water on the Great Plains is, and it should be, complicated and difficult. As we uncover its history, we uncover a trail of folly, misjudgment, ignorance, greed, and failure, along with triumphs, success, and wonderful achievements. But we can also find in the past, as we find today, people struggling together to define standards of fairness, responsibility toward future generations, and ways to protect the nature that supports us. My concluding words: as we face the end of abundance, an end we have helped bring on by waste and exploitation, we will have to know better than we do the complicated history of water and other resources. We will also inescapably, I think, have to ask, what are the moral values that should guide our future use of water? Thank you very much. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the E.N. Thompson Forum on World Issues on Noon Forum. The E.N. Thompson Forum is co-sponsored by the Cooper Foundation, the LEAD Center, and the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Today's guest speaker was Donald Worster, the Hall Distinguished Professor of American History at the University of Kansas. He spoke on the topic, An Unquenchable Thirst, How the Great Plains Created a Water Abundance and Then Lost It. Dr. Worster's presentation was co-sponsored by the Symposium 1862-2012, The Making of the Great Plains. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, March 28, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Katie Cervantes, E.N. Thompson Forum Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.